Will you come and talk to us, John?
Thank you, Dick. Appreciate it. Now, listen, I just got to say, when Dick sat around the picnic table with us 5 years ago, I did kind of think he was crazy. But apparently he's not. He's on to something here. So thanks for the work that you do. I don't know if you guys realize the work that he puts into this. Not only that, but the lineup that has been here in Billings, Montana for the last 5 years is really spectacular. And this lineup that's coming up, including Mark David Hall next month, my friends Brett Kunkel, Jay Warner Wallace. You're not going to want to miss Jay Warner Wallace. He has been on Dateline 2020 because of his work as a L.A. homicide detective, and he applied those same skills as an atheist to the evidence for Christianity and landed in the right place based on his examination of the evidence. He's as good as it gets as an apologist. Dick, you've done a great job. And so I just want to recognize that. So great job. Great lineup. My job this weekend is to look at culture. And we're going to get really specific tomorrow, particularly on the issue of same-sex marriage and what we might call the culture of sexual brokenness. But what we want to do tonight is kind of frame out some sort of approach. How do we even talk and look at culture? A lot of Christians, as I travel around right now, a lot of Christians are really struggling with what it means to be faithful to the gospel in this particular cultural moment. What we might say is this, that the key question, one of the key questions we're facing as a church right now in American culture, in Western culture, is how will we deal with increasing cultural pressure, right? Do you feel the increasing cultural pressure? Right, tomorrow morning, we're going to talk about same-sex marriage. I talked to a pastor about 3 years ago in the write-up of and leading up to writing a book on same-sex marriage, and he kind of typified what I hear a lot of Christians say. He looked at me, and this is a guy that was in the fight as a pastor for his state's legislation on how they define marriage, and he looked at me in great despair, and he said, John, and this is what he said to me, and I quote, John, it's over, we've lost. And there's a lot of Christians, I think, that because of the Obergefell decision this summer, because of some of the other things that we see, they have this feeling of despair, like we've lost. Well, even if you're not quite there yet, I think most of us would agree there's an increasing pressure. There's an increasing squeezing out of the place of religion and faith in the public square. And that's what's happening here in the United States. You talk about the cultural pressure that's being faced by the Christian church worldwide, and it really intensifies, right? I mean, we've got brothers and sisters in some of the ancient Christian communities on the planet that the cultural pressure that they're feeling is imprisonment, rape, beheadings, crucifixions, and things like that. It's becoming a tough world for Christians. In fact, some statistics say that last year, more Christians were subject to persecution than at any time in history. I mean, we think about persecution of Christians, and we see it in the other, and we kind of see it in, you know, the church fathers and the time of Nero and maybe some of the Roman emperors and so on. But no, those times are back. I'm not ready to use the word persecution for what Christians in the United States face. Now, we've got these isolated incidents, obviously, what happened in Oregon. If the stories are correct, that it's so far that we've heard that this guy targeted Christians, that would be a form of persecution. When our brothers and sisters around the world are being kind of crucified and so on, that's a whole nother level than losing our nonprofit or tax-exempt status, right? You see what I'm saying? But there's no question that we're being squeezed, right? Where do we fit? How do we think about this? And then the most important question, what do we do? How can we be faithful to the gospel in this moment? Now, let me give you a couple punchlines here as we begin talking about culture. And this first session is just going to set up kind of a framework of our responsibility. The first thing is, let me just give you this punchline, we've kind of historically, Christians have done a pretty lousy job understanding culture, and culture has done a pretty lousy job understanding Christians. Can we just start right there? I live in Colorado Springs, moved there in 2007, and when we moved there, there was a church there that was very famous, and it was famous for all the wrong reasons. The pastor of this church was a guy named Ted Haggard. Does that ring a bell? So the church was New Life Church. Ted Haggard was a nationally known evangelical pastor, had a fall from grace, I guess you could say. A new pastor came in, a remarkable leader, a guy named Brady. He's a friend of mine. And he said that his job was to get the church out of the media spotlight, which he was only able to do for a few months. Because on a Sunday morning, in fact, we had just moved to town about a month prior to this. We were driving around that morning looking for a church. and we had that we were going to visit. We had the radio up, and suddenly I heard this news bulletin come across the radio station we were listening to. There's been a shooting at New Life Church. Did you guys hear about this story? A few months after Ted Haggard left, a grumpy 20-something YWAMer showed up at a YWAM base in Arvada, Colorado, shot two people in the middle of the night when they answered the door, killed them, and then came to New Life Church loaded with ammunition. I mean, the amount of firepower he had was just unreal. And he shot two people in the parking lot and was aiming at the hundreds of people that were being let go after the 11 o'clock service. He shot two people in the door of the church. A security guard who was there said she heard from the Lord that morning that she was going to have to do something. She shot the guy after he shot four people there at the church, a horrific event. And I was driving around that morning, and suddenly there was a news flash. There's been a shooting at New Life Church. So I started to listen in. And then in a matter of minutes, the news reporter said, hey, we've got somebody that has called in who saw the first parts of the shooting take place. Now, I don't quite understand the chronology of this, but apparently there was a guy, saw two people get shot in the parking lot of the church, got scared, ran down the hill, flagged down a car, and whether he was calling the police station first or the radio station first, I'm not real sure. All I know is that I'm listening on this Sunday morning as he's talking to this radio announcer. And this radio announcer keeps asking him, and she asked him a question. Was Mass still going on when the shooting took place? Now, New Life Church is a charismatic, evangelical rock band on Sunday morning. I think they have a smoke machine and strobe lights, right? So she said, was Mass still going on when the shooting took place? And he replied, huh? And she said, was Mass still going on when the shooting took place? And he said, huh? And she said, was Mass still going on when the shooting took place? And he said, huh? And she said, was Mass still going on? I promise you, this went back and forth no fewer than eight times. Now think about this, though. This is in Colorado Springs. Have you heard about our town? The last count I saw in the newspaper, there are 3,000 501c3 religious nonprofit organizations in Colorado Springs. Everything from the $400 million, in fact, they're almost to a billion now, dollar Compassion International, Focus on the Family, you know, these big organizations, to the Christian Cowboy Association. There's like three of those, by the way. They had a split. It was really ugly. And you know, but this is a town. She is a news reporter in a town with all of these religious groups, and including the flagship ones in America, and she doesn't know enough about Christianity to know that, well, New Life Church wouldn't have Mass. This guy didn't know enough about Christianity even know what Mass was, and there was just this ridiculous exchange, right? Now, where does this kind of cultural confusion between the church and the larger culture come from? Well, I think it comes primarily because oftentimes, at least on our side, I think, you know, from the kind of the larger culture side, they've got their own issues to deal with. But on our side, the confusion comes because most often when we have approached the larger culture over the last 60, 70 years, we've started with the wrong first question. I'm not saying it's the wrong question, like we should never ask it. It's just the wrong first question. And here's the first question that Christians have tended to ask when it comes to culture: where do I draw the line? Where do I draw the line? And what we've done is we've kind of segmented ourselves from culture by drawing this line and saying everything on this side of the line is Christian and everything on that side of the line is worldly. Everything on this side of the line is sacred and everything on this side of the line is secular. Everything on this side of the line is good and everything on this side of the line is bad. When I was growing up, and I grew up in kind of this environment, and there was this line, and it was like, Christian music, good. Rock music, bad. And then somebody made Christian rock music. Man, we didn't know what to do. Like, it was really, it was a confusing couple decades. And then like, it was like, no going to movies, right? That's bad. But then Billy Graham started to make movies, right? And then I think we just kind of settled on, if a movie has Kirk Cameron, it's okay, right? And so it was just kind of this, like, line. Now, I think we do have to get there, right? We have to decide which movies, which songs, which TV shows to get into. But that's not the way to start to approach culture. The way to approach anything in life as a Christian is at a different starting point. It's not based on where's my line. It's based on where is my responsibility. What's the scope of the Lordship of Jesus Christ And what claim does it have in my life? Let me phrase it in a different way. And this is the way some friends of mine at the Acton Institute have phrased it in a new program they have called For the Life of the World. It's a great first question. And I want to start with this first question. What is our salvation for? You know, as Christians, we spend a lot of time talking about what our salvation is from. And you know what? We should never forget what we have been saved from. We have been saved from sin. We have been saved from death. We have been saved from condemnation. We have been saved from God's wrath, right? And if that's all salvation did was save us from that stuff, it'd still be a sweet deal. But there's more. Sometimes we talk about what are we saved to, which is a great question. We'll talk about we're saved to eternal life. We're saved to the glory of Christ. But here's the other question. What are we saved for? Right? I don't know about you, but when I was growing up, kind of in a Christian circle, I had these tough questions for God. And one of the tough questions for God that I once had, that I often had was this. If the whole point is to get to heaven, why doesn't God just take me to heaven the moment that I decide to become a Christian? Anybody ever wonder this? You know what I'm talking about? Yeah, that would make it a lot simpler. I wouldn't struggle with that sin, you know? I wouldn't struggle with that idiot that makes me sin, right? I mean, there's all kinds of benefits to this, you know? And so I would wonder this as I was growing up. And then I became a teenager and I was like, well, I don't want to go to heaven just yet. I want to get married first. You know, things like that. But, you know, these are legitimate things. You ever wonder why that is the case, right? That's this question. What are we saved for? Between the moment of salvation and the realization, the full realization of eternal life in the presence of Jesus, what are we saved for? What is our responsibility now? I want to tell you a story that to me really helps underscore the significance of this question and what it means to take seriously our responsibility to our cultural moment. It's the story of a group of students called the White Rose Society. Has anybody ever heard of this group, the White Rose Society? A handful of you have. This was a student group at the University of Munich. And they were during the time of the Third Reich, and they were disgusted by what they saw Hitler and the Nazis doing. And they just felt like, you know what, we have got to do something about this. And so what they decided to do, and it was led by a guy named Hans Scholl. This is Hans Scholl right here, and this is his sister Sophie Scholl. In fact, if you want a great movie to watch about this story, there's a German film with subtitles on Netflix called Sophie Scholl, The Last Days. And Scholl is spelled, by the way, S-C-H-O-L-L. Sophie Scholl, The Last Day, or The Final Days, maybe. And it's a wonderful story about this group. And so this group of students decided they had to do something. So what they did is over a series of a couple years, they published a series of pamphlets. And they distributed them around the community. They mailed them to homes. They distributed them around the university campus. And, of course, they had to do so anonymously, because if they got caught, they would be executed and so on. And so they did this five or six times. When they were doing their final distribution, they were doing it at the university campus. The students were all in an assembly, and so they were trying to get it around before the assembly was over. And Sophie Scholl saw a suitcase that hadn't been distributed of full of flyers, and so she ran it up to the top of the university tower. She dumped it out. It went all over the campus. And that's when a janitor spotted her. And that was the beginning of the end. Within 4 days, they had been brought in for questioning. They had been accused. They had been tried. They had been convicted. And they had been executed, all within 4 days. And in fact, they were executed by guillotine. Sophie, and that's how that was the end of the White Rose Society. Hans Scholl had a motto. And this motto kind of framed why he was doing what he was doing. Here's how he would say it. We are Christian and we are German. Therefore, we are responsible for Germany. Do you see what he's saying? We are Christian, we are German, therefore, we are responsible for Germany. I had the privilege over the last couple years of his life to work with the late, great Chuck Colson. And Chuck had a close friend he collaborated with on a number of initiatives, a guy named Richard John Newhouse. And Newhouse once wrote an article for which he got into some hot water. The article, he said this, when I meet God, I expect to meet him as an American. People didn't like that. But people didn't understand what he was saying. People were thinking, well, wait a minute, are you saying that the only way to meet God is if you're an American or that God will be an American? He wasn't saying any of that. What he was saying is that who he was, A significant part of who he was an American. And he couldn't choose to meet God not as an American because he didn't choose to be an American in the first place. Does that make any sense? Let me give you a passage of Scripture. If you're taking notes, please take a look at this later on. Acts chapter 17. This is a passage loaded with great advice and a story from which you can glean all kinds of good thinking on what it means to engage the culture. But I want you to hear what Paul himself says in the middle of Acts 17 as he's presenting this God that the Athenians don't know. Now, you remember, if you ever looked at that passage, he's speaking to Athens. He's speaking to the philosophers of Athens up on Mars Hill. This is a group of people who love gods. They love gods, not God, but gods, right? They love to explore gods. It says like they love to do nothing more than to sit around and talk about the latest ideas, right? And they had gods for everything. They had an unknown god just in case they forgot one. They didn't want to offend him too, right? And so that was Athens. And so Paul gets this opportunity to explain who the real God is. And here's what he says. It's somewhere around verse 24-ish. It says something like this. The God who made everything determined the exact times that people live in the boundaries of their dwelling place. Did you catch that? God intentionally determined that you and I would be living in this time and in this place and not in another time and not in another place. The God who created everything determines the exact times that people live and the boundaries of their dwelling place. In other words, what Richard John Neuhaus was saying was, God determined that I'm an American. What Hans Scholl was saying is, I'm a Christian and I'm a German, and these two things aren't accidental to each other. They're not incidental to each other. That God determined, when God called me, he also made me a German. And so somehow these two things have something to do with each other. Does that make sense? So here's what I want to challenge you to think about right now. If you're taking notes, write it down this way. If you're not, just let this ruminate in your thinking a little bit. I am Christian and I am blank. Therefore, I'm responsible for what? What are the situations in your life that you didn't choose? I'm Christian and I'm American. I'm Christian and I'm male. I'm Christian and I'm a husband. I'm Christian and I'm a mother. I'm Christian and I'm Montanian. Is that a word? I don't even know, right? And so therefore, I'm responsible for what? This is really easy in Texas. I'm Christian and I'm Texan, therefore I'm responsible for the universe. You know how Texans are. It's really like that. But you get the point, right? I'm Christian and I'm what? That somehow God, what Hans Scholl believed is that God put these two things together. That God determines the time and the places in which we live. By the way, I don't think that's proof texting. If you look at throughout the text of Scripture, from Genesis to Revelation, what you'll find is that the God of Christianity is a God extremely concerned with time and place. He's putting things at just the right time and in just the right place. Take a look, for example, at Galatians chapter 4, verse 4. He talks about how that was actually the case with Jesus Christ himself. We have a letter that Hans Scholl wrote to a friend of his. Don't know a lot about the friend, but this was a letter that was written a few years before he was executed. And this letter talks about the struggle that Hans Scholl went through in order to come to this conclusion that he had to act. That to be Christian and to be German meant to actually be involved in the resistance movement and deny his country's leadership and try to subversively undermine it and so on and so on. Here's how the letter goes. Even though May came in accompanied by rain, all the fields were bright with the loveliest green imaginable. A sunbeam pierced a little gap in the dark sea of cloud, and the world laughed and glittered in the light of heaven. Let me just stop right there. You live in Montana. Have you guys ever seen a beautiful sunrise or a beautiful sunset? Of course you have. Here's what I realized, and maybe it's obvious to the rest of you, but when I first saw this, it struck me like a ton of bricks. There were beautiful sunrises in Nazi Germany. There were beautiful sunsets during the Holocaust. How do you hold that together? How do you hold together the fact that in one of the most disturbing moments in world history, where some of the worst human atrocities imaginable were being carried out, that God on a daily basis was displaying his beauty and his glory in the midst of the brokenness? And see, here's the question that it demands that we ask. How do you handle living in a world that's profoundly beautiful and profoundly ugly? How do you handle living in a world in which there is profound capacity for goodness and truth and beauty and profound capacity for evil and pain and suffering. We've seen some of that even in the last week. The shooting in Oregon, the flooding in South Carolina. The world we live in is this mix of good and evil. It really is, isn't it? In fact, it's not just the world, it's the human heart. Think about this. It was the Nazi generals who went home and hugged their own kids who earlier that day had gassed Jewish kids. See, the only world we've ever lived in is one that's profoundly good because God created it that way, and profoundly fallen because something's gone desperately wrong. How do you hold those two things together? This is the wrestling match that was put in front of Han Scholl in a very real place. And it's being put in front of us too. How do we handle this profound goodness and profound evil in the world? He says this, I stood there marveling and I thought to myself, does God take us for fools that he should light up the world for us with such consummate beauty in the radiance of his glory and in his honor and nothing on the other hand but rapine and murder? He sounds like the psalmist, doesn't he? You ever read the Psalms? David says the same sort of thing, doesn't he? David says, God, why do the heathen rage? God, why do the righteous suffer and the wicked prosper? Why do we live in a world where these two things happen? And don't you feel that way? Right? Why do we live in a world where those who are trying very often to raise godly families are the ones that are facing the cultural pressure, and those that really are kind of building a whole system of life out of kind of a narcissistic self-fulfillment seem to be getting all the breaks? Do you ever feel that tension? Listen, if we don't feel that tension between the goodness and the fallenness in the world, we're not paying attention. That's the world we live in. So what do we do? So where does the truth lie? Should one go off and build a little house with flowers outside the windows and a garden outside the door and extol and thank God and turn one's back in the world, on the world and its filth? And you think about it, he could have done that, right? I mean, he could have moved up into the hills of Germany. He could have built himself a nice little house. He could have put his rocking chair on the front porch so that his back was always to Auschwitz and his back was always to Berlin. And you think, wow, if he could have done that in Nazi Germany, how much easier is it for us to do that today? Right? I'm just going to say this out front. I wonder sometimes if one of the great idols of the Christian community in our day is the idol of safety. And I think sometimes you see this idol come to light when you see cultural ground being lost. Because it doesn't seem that we're concerned about religious liberty because the world is losing something good and beneficial for everyone. We're kind of concerned about religious liberty because we're losing what we once had. You see the difference? And you know what? The majority of our brothers and sisters around the world right now and the majority of our brothers and sisters throughout history did not live in a safe world. We've had this illusion of safety. And sometimes I think that's what we do. In fact, we can kind of build up systems so that we can stay in our Christian, what many people have called a holy huddle. Right? We can draw that line and we can stay safely bunkered in here and we can just throw Bible verse bombs over the wall at those pagans. Do you know what I'm talking about? And we can throw, and this is one of the things that really why I told Dick this is what I wanted to speak on today is because as we lose ground in the culture, and that certainly is the case, right? But many Christians have retreated into a place as if outrage is a cultural strategy. And as if outrage is the expression of the gospel that Christ has called us to. Outrage is not an answer. What do we do? What are we called to do? What is our responsibility? What is our salvation for? Here's what he said. Isn't seclusion a form of treachery, of desertion? I'm weak and puny, but I want to do what is right. That's a haunting line if you ask me. Isn't seclusion a form of treachery? I would say it this way. Isn't safety a form of idolatry? What is our salvation for? Now this makes me really uncomfortable. You know why? Because I'm the dad of three little girls. right? I would prefer to hunker down with my guns. And I have 3 daughters, and I lived in Tennessee. I have guns. And my dog. He's a wimp, though. He wouldn't help. But what is our salvation for? Here's what Dietrich Bonhoeffer, he's a theologian that I've become really fascinated with. I don't necessarily agree with all of his theology. He was kind of all over the place. But what Bonhoeffer believed about Christianity could be summed up in a statement that he wrote to his former seminary students. How many of you guys know Bonhoeffer, by the way? Anybody not know Bonhoeffer? Like, this is a new name. Okay, most of you know Bonhoeffer, a handful of you. Okay, so Bonhoeffer was a German pastor theologian who was also at the time of Hitler and the Third Reich, and he was doing all kinds of subversive activities. He was trying to bring pressure to bear from the outside of Germany onto Hitler. He tried to start a confessing church when the German church capitulated to Nazism and to anti-Semitism. He was trying to do all kinds of things, and a lot of his projects got shut down, but he kept in touch with his underground seminary that he'd started with the students every Christmas. And in one letter near the end of his life, in a letter called Stations on the Way to Freedom, here's what he said. Bravely take hold of the real, not dallying now with what might be. Not in the flight of ideas, but only in action is freedom. And here's the punchline. Ready? Make up your mind and come out into the tempest of the living. You see, for Bonhoeffer, the only Christianity there was Christianity with boots on the ground. There was no such thing as a Christianity that was a separatist Christianity that was intent on escaping life in the world. That like our Savior Jesus Christ, who was the Word who became, how's that go? Flesh. And did what? Dwelt among us. That Christians belonged in the human predicament just like Christ came into the human predicament. Does that make sense? That we follow this Christ. In other words, what we might say, and this is kind of a punchline, in my next talk I'm going to deal with this a little bit more, that Christianity, what Bonhoeffer believed is that Christianity wasn't just a way of being religious. In other words, it wasn't just one religion among many. It wasn't just a way to get private spiritual satisfaction or to find meaning and purpose, right? And by the way, I would even say this, Christianity is not even just merely a way of being moral. But what Christianity offers us is the story of humanity from Genesis to Revelation. Does that make sense? In fact, where does the story of Christianity begin? In the what? Beginning. And where does it end? In Revelation, right? Which you really can't call the end, right? Because it's not really the end. It's the new beginning. We all read Narnia. That's what happens. Okay. Yeah. So Christianity offers this way of being human. And so I'm going to come back to that in the next session. But let me give you the punchline for that. And that is this, that escape is not an option for Christians. There are escapist religions. There are escapist worldviews. For example, Buddhism is an escapist religion. The point of Buddhism is escape. Did you know that? That you're supposed to escape in your mind to a place of contentment, and so you would escape suffering and therefore escape desire and therefore escape suffering. Hinduism is an escapist religion as well. Literally escapist. Like the goal of Hinduism is to escape reincarnation and join the fabric of oneness and lose your individuality. That's what the point is. Oprahism is an escapist worldview, right? Is that you're supposed to think happy thoughts and not negative thoughts, and then you get good parking spots at Christmas, right? So this is escapism, right? But Christianity is not escapist, really for 2 reasons. Here's the first reason, ready? Is that humans really can escape culture. We can try, but we can't escape. There are people kind of saying we can kind of escape into our Christian bunkers. It's just not possible. I know this because, as I said, I'm the dad of 3 little girls. Here they are. My oldest daughter, Abigail, is 10. My middle daughter, Anna, is 8. My youngest daughter, Allie, is 6. I know you can't escape because I've tried to escape those Disney princesses, right? Everything in my house has one of those princesses on it. I lost. They won. The princesses won. I'm just going to say that, right? Everything. My curtains have princesses on it. My plates. My toothbrush. My lawnmower. You know, it's really ridiculous. And we live in Colorado Springs. We live a pretty conservative place, but culture still gets in. My wife was putting on a praise CD at breakfast the other day. It was about a year ago. And the song was 10,000 Reasons. Do you know that song, Bless the Lord, Oh My Soul? It's a great song. And my middle daughter, Anna, who thinks out loud, piped up, "Hey, Daddy, is that Justin Bieber?" No idea. We never had a Justin Bieber song play in my house. So we spanked her, and I'm just getting into that. You can't escape culture. But the deeper point that Bonhoeffer was trying to make is that we shouldn't. That Christian faithfulness is not escapist. And that's what I want to wrestle with, because if we're honest with ourselves, Christians have a reputation for being escapist, right? For not getting our hands dirty in the real problems of the world and so on. And this is a reputation that goes back at least as far as the 19th century. Friedrich Nietzsche, the great atheist who said God is dead, also said that there were two great European narcotics, alcohol and Christianity. Now, you know what he's saying there? He said in his day, there were two things that were keeping Europe numb and dumb and distracted. One was alcohol, the other was Christianity, so he was against both of them. Very similar, by the way, if you go into the history of philosophy, Karl Marx said something very similar. You know this line, right? Religion is the what? That's what he was saying. Christianity is an escapism. Jean-Jacques Rousseau definitely believed this. He said, what does it matter if one is free or slave in this veil of tears? The essential thing is to get to heaven, and resignation is one more means towards that. True Christians, he said, are made to be slaves. They know it and they're not concerned by it because this short life is too unimportant in their eyes. So you see what he was saying? That Christianity was escapist because Christianity only cared about the next life and didn't have anything at all really substantial to say about what? This life. Is that true? Is that Christianity? Is Christianity all about being saved from and not about being saved for? You might let these guys off the hook for saying this, if you, because sometimes some of the things that we say kind of can give that impression. Some of the songs we sing, some of the ways we talk about being on this earth and going to heaven when we die, which of course these are all true things, but we sometimes talk about this world doesn't matter. I used to live in the South. The South is known for all kinds of really good stuff, like sweet tea, right? Which is the nectar of the gods. But one of the things that they're not great at is church billboards. Do you guys have church billboards here? With the kind of the sayings, you know what I'm saying? I remember driving past one that said this, Walmart isn't the only savings place. But there was one that there was one billboard I remember passing once, and it said this, Jesus is the only good thing left in a bad world. It sounds spiritual, doesn't it? But if you think about it, if that were true, why would I go to their church? Is Jesus the only good thing left in a bad world? Is there no good art? Is there no good poetry? Is there no good meals? I see enough grandmas in here to know that cannot be true. Do you see it, the language that we're using? The language that we're using makes it seem like the entire world is hopeless, that there's nothing left to do here except hunker down and wait to be rescued and wait for escape. Is that Christian, is the question that I'm asking. There's a hymn that I really like that could be misconstrued in this way. I really like it. It meant a lot to a lot of my mentors. I remember singing this growing up. You guys probably remember this hymn by Helen Limmel, Turn Your Eyes Upon Jesus. Remember this song? Beautiful. Turn your eyes upon Jesus, look full in his wonderful face. By the way, is that a good idea or a bad idea? It's a good idea. Paul says, fix your eyes on Jesus, the author and the finisher of our faith. But look at that third line. And the things of earth will grow strangely dim. When we walk with the Lord, do the things of earth grow dimmer? Or do the things of earth come into focus? Is the point of our faith that we focus so much on Jesus that things like family and government and business and poverty, the things of earth, that they grow unimportant? Or is the point of my faith that I look through Jesus as I look at him so that I can properly understand everything else? In other words, here's my question. Does Christian faith make the world grow dimmer? Or does Christian faith bring the world into sharp focus so that I can actually understand it as God would have me understand it? Can I take you to a passage of Scripture? I've already mentioned it once. John chapter 1. In the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and all things were made through him, and without him nothing was made that has been made. Verse 4, in him was life, And that life was the light of men. And verse 5, and the light did something. What did the light do? The light what? Shone in the darkness. And the darkness what? Comprehended it not. And the darkness did not overcome it. Have you ever been out on your porch on a really dark night and then flipped on the porch light? What happens? Does the yard kind of light up or does the dark rush in your house? Listen, if you live in a house and the dark rushes in your house, you need to move. All right, I'm seriously. They make movies about your house, you always die, okay? Do not stay in that house. No. You get the point. Listen, and this is, again, not a proof text. If you know anything about John's gospel and John's letters, and especially John's revelation, those two phrases, light and life, light and life, light and life, what John wants you to understand, because Christ has come, because the Word has become flesh and dwelt among us, and because He has overcome death, here's what John wants you to know from really throughout his gospel. He chooses 7 miracles that have to do with light and life. He chooses 7 discourses that Jesus has that has to do with light and life. That's why John is so radically different than Matthew, Mark, and Luke and how it's put together. John wants you to know these things. Ready? Life overcomes death and light defeats darkness. This is what he says. And this is the truth. This is not true for him and not true for us. This is not true back in the day of the early church and suddenly stopped being true because the Supreme Court decided to do something different. Does that make sense? The truth of the universe is that Jesus Christ is the light that overcomes the darkness, and he is the life that resurrects, that he has been resurrected, and therefore he overcomes death. And that will never change. And this is where we begin. We begin with this reality that our faith doesn't block us from the world. Jesus is the light. In him, there is no shadows. There is no dimness. There is no shifting darkness. In fact, just compare what this song seems to imply versus this song by Maddie Babcock, "This Is My Father's World." This is my Father's world, and to my listening ears, all nature sings and round me rings the music of the spheres. Doesn't seem to be saying the same thing, does it? This is my Father's world. He shines in all that's fair. In the rustling grass, I hear him pass. He speaks to me everywhere. Scripture says every good and perfect gift comes from above. Verse 3, and I don't know about you, but after this last week, after this last year, after seeing these Planned Parenthood videos and everything else, we need to remind ourselves of verse 3. So can we read that together? Can you guys see it up there? Let's read it together. You know it, verse 3. This is my Father's world. Oh, let me never forget that though the wrong seems all so strong, and all God's people said what? Do you realize there's never been a moment in human history where God has looked down and went, ah, God never does that. Wouldn't that be a bad day if God was like, ah, God never does that. Right? He is the ruler you're at. This is my Father's world. Why should my heart be sad? The Lord is king. Let the heavens ring. God reigns. Let the earth be glad. I was going to give you this Bonhoeffer quote, which was going to change your life, but I'm out of time. So sorry about that. All right. So the first point is that escape is not an option. But there's an equal temptation. There's an opposite temptation that many Christians are finding. And that is the temptation to accommodate. The temptation to think that the cultural moment is so overwhelming that I have to change historic Orthodox Christianity in order to, I don't know, stay relevant. Have you heard some of this? Yeah. So we're going to be talking a little bit more about this tomorrow, but the classic issue right now on this has to do with what my friend Jay Richards calls all the pelvic issues. Anything having to do with sex, anything having to do with marriage, anything having to do with that region, right? There's this unbelievable temptation to accommodate. And we hear that, right? Christians are going to go into the dustbin of history. We're on the wrong side of history if you hold to these conservative views about marriage that we now know are no longer. Have you heard some of these things? Listen, I just want you to understand, every single generation of Christians is tempted to accommodate to the spirit of the age. We don't face, it may be a different issue, but you know what? Our brothers and sisters on the other side of the world are being attempted to accommodate to Islam. The first Christians were tempted to accommodate to Caesar. Right? In other words, one of the most important things that Christians must remember, right, is that the cultural moment we live in, it's real. The pressure is significant. We feel it, and we feel the temptation to escape, or we feel the temptation to accommodate. But what happens when we escape or accommodate is we think that the cultural moment is the real story of the world, rather than the cultural moment being real, but it's just that, it's a moment. The real story of the world is death has been defeated by light, and darkness has been run out by light. Does that make sense? In other words, don't confuse the moment and the story. The moment is the culture. The story is Christ has risen from the dead. I remember thinking that when that pastor looked at me, and I get it. I know where he was coming from. And he was a warrior, so he deserves our respect because he was willing to fight. But when he looked at me and he said, "It's over, we've lost." The only thing I could think is, wait a minute, what's it that's over? Who's we that have lost? It's not over, we've lost. It's finished. He has won. You see what I mean? We have to keep the moment and the story straight. Let me give you a couple ways that I think we're tempted to accommodate. The first way we're tempted to accommodate is clearly on beliefs. We're tempted to accommodate our beliefs, right? By the way, I love what Russell Moore, who's the head of the RLC, says. You know, now we're asking questions about sexuality, and people are telling us you got to accommodate on sexuality. Back at the early part of the 20th century, what they were trying to accommodate on is the virgin birth. Does that make sense? And the churches that accommodated to the virgin, that said, no, virgins don't have babies, and we know this because of our science. And by the way, Jesus probably didn't physically rise from the dead, but he's a good moral example. And the Bible's not really true, but science is. You know, all those churches that kind of went that way, what happened to those churches? What are the emptiest churches on the planet or in America right now? Are those. Accommodation. By the way, accommodation to the culture is the quickest way to empty your church. Because if you accommodate to the culture and nothing new is being heard on a Sunday morning, why do people go to church to hear nothing new? Does that make any sense? But we're tempted to accommodate on beliefs. And the thing we have to remember is that Christianity is true. It's not just true for me and true for you. What we mean is that it's true. It's true whether we believe it or not. The second way, though, we're tempted to accommodate, and this is a real subtle thing that happens, is that we're tempted to accommodate through not only beliefs, but also methods. The most common way that I think Christians have been tempted to accommodate on methods is what Chuck Colson used to call the political illusion. The political illusion basically sees all culture as being political. Now, politics is a very important part of culture. It's a huge part of culture. It's even one of the many indicators of where culture is going. But have you noticed that almost every issue in our culture right now has become politicized? So if you stand up on the issue of abortion, you're being political. Does that make sense? It's almost all political. Now, we kind of fall into that trap sometimes. We think then that what will save America is my candidate in the office. We think that what will save America is if our party is in charge and those bums are run out. It's what's called the political illusion. Here's what Chuck Colson used to say, and this is really important to remember, I think especially over the next few months. Ready? Salvation does not come in Air Force One. All right? Now, I'm not saying don't vote. Good heavens, vote. Right? I'm not saying that who gets into the White House doesn't matter. Are you kidding me? Of course it matters. Right? What I'm saying is that politics isn't everything. I remember when I figured, when I finally, it kind of hit me. I was in some of these meetings leading up to some of the marriage decisions. And the strategy, the political strategy that a group of conservatives have really latched onto was the strategy of passing state-level marriage amendments. right? So you remember this. It wasn't that long ago. State by state, we're going to put a marriage amendment in. And there's going to be a defining of marriage as between a man and a woman on the state level. And do you remember how successful that was? It was unbelievable. It was unbelievable. They would send it to the people, and the people would vote marriage as between a man and a woman. And it went 30 to nothing. 30 straight marriage amendments. And you know what? They were probably helpful in holding off same-sex marriage for probably 3 years. Those were political wins. The problem was those political wins could not hold back the cultural tsunami. Do you understand what I'm saying? We didn't get same-sex marriage from politics. We got it in the cultural imagination through movies, through media, you know, and so on, and through Facebook memes. Right? Does that make sense? In other words, it's not always true. Politics is an important part of culture, but most of the time, politics is downstream from culture. If we put all of our eggs in the political basket, we're going to be disappointed. Because there's a lot of different parts of culture. There's the arts. There's education. In fact, I would suggest, and we'll get into this a little bit more tomorrow, that the two most important culture-shaping arenas are the arts and education. Where arts and education goes is where politics eventually ends up. Does that make any sense? You can see this with the sexual revolution, for example. The sexual revolution, same-sex marriage is the result of the sexual revolution. We'll talk more about this tomorrow. But where did we get the sexual revolution? We got it from an artist and an educator. The educator was a woman named Mary Calderon. Mary Calderon founded the Sexuality Information and Education Caucus of the United States. She started that movement to get sex education in schools. And the artist, and I'm using that term kind of loosely, but really he went through the arts. The artist was Hugh Hefner. You're like, very loosely. I get it. But it was the arts. And by the way, who gave Mary Calderon her first big grant to get her organization off the ground? Hugh Hefner. Hefner said Playboy is the magazine that changed America. And he's right. In the 1950s, you couldn't find that. You had to go to a seedy back part of the store. Now Hugh Hefner is a celebrity. You see what I mean? And then trace it through the history of television, which we'll do tomorrow, from the 80s to the 90s, from the Cosby Show to Seinfeld. Pretty dramatic change, right? Does that make any sense? And so we're tempted to accommodate in beliefs, and we're tempted to accommodate in methods. Here's the third way. Ready? We're tempted to accommodate in habits. Just habits. Part of being an American is to be tempted by habits of materialism. There's a habit that we have as a nation. The day after we give thanks, we spend the whole day giving thanks, then we trample security guards for flat-screen TVs. Right? It's just normal. It's just part of what we do. Habits, looking at these little glowing rectangles all the time. Right? Right? So there are ways that culture shapes us. And that's one of the fundamental questions. Culture does have a shaping impact in our lives. Christians are to be culture shapers more than culture shaped. So what does this look like? Well, if our call is not to be escapist, if our call is not to be accommodating, our call is to be hopefully engaged. And I want to unpack this a little bit. Hopefully engaged. What do we mean by hopeful? What do we mean by engaged? Well, first of all, I want to go back here and say, well, what is our salvation for? That was the topic of this film series. That's the topic that, and by the way, Dick's got a couple copies of this great curriculum series called For the Life of the World. If you've got high schoolers, you should go through this with them. If you teach an adult Sunday school class, the For the Life of the World program is great. And my latest book, written with my good friend Warren Smith, who's been here as a speaker as well, Restoring All Things, wrestles with this. What does it look like to be hopefully engaged? Let me hit it on a couple different angles. First of all, what do we mean? What's the scope of our engagement? How wide should Christian cultural engagement be? I love this line from G.K. Chesterton because, by the way, Chesterton is somebody you should read. He was brilliant and always grumpy, so he's a lot of fun. And Chesterton said this, if Christianity should happen to be true, if its God is the real God of the universe, defending it may mean talking about anything and everything. You see, here's the problem. Here's the problem with the line thing. when we talk as if there are some parts of culture that are Christian and some parts of culture that are secular, we're forgetting that Jesus Christ claimed to be sovereign over everything. There is no secular part of the world and sacred part of the world. The earth is the, fill in the blank, Lord's and the what? Fullness thereof. And this is what Chesterton's trying to wrestle with. The problem isn't politics. The problem is that politics has been taken into a direction away from the lordship of Christ. The problem isn't fashion. The problem is that fashion has been taken away in a direction away from the lordship of Christ. I learned this from a 20-something. I got done speaking and this 20-something girl grabbed her 20-something friend and she dragged her up to me and she said, "Thank you." And I said, "Why?" She said, "Because you said we need Christian fashion designers." And I had said that, but I had forgotten because I had completely went off on a stream of conscience. I know that's hard for you to believe. And I was just on this rambling thing in the middle of this talk, and I was like, we need Christian lawyers and Christian doctors and Christian filmmakers and Christian engineers and Christian politicians and Christian fashion designers. And she remembered that. But the problem was she asked me about it, but I had never thought that thought before that moment, and I had nothing to say. So what I did is what you do when you get put on the spot when you're a speaker. I said, "Well, you're right. Tell me why you think we need Christian fashion designers." Here's what she said. She said, "Well, my friend here is into fashion. She's really good. And she's growing up the ladder at her company, and they really like her because she does really good work." And she says, "And I tell her all the time how important it is that she does her job." I said, "Well, why is that?" She said, "Because fashion designers teach culture what beautiful is." Is God the God of beauty? Then God's the God of fashion. Is God the God of truth? Then God is the God of science and of engineering and of law and anything else that has to do with truth. Does that make sense? And when we segment reality, and we do this in very subtle sort of ways. We do this with altar calls at the end of the service where we tell people to surrender to the ministry. And what we mean by that is pastor and missionary. If you're a pastor in here, have an altar call and invite people that God's calling to be the next full-time Christian, I don't know, lawyer. I know that sounds like an oxymoron. It's not. Wouldn't it be great? Because God, Christ is Lord of what? Oh, one of Chuck's favorite quotations, one of my favorite quotations, is from a Dutch theologian and statesman named Abraham Kuyper. Kuyper said this, "There's not a single square inch in the whole domain of human existence where Jesus Christ, who is sovereign over all, does not cry out, 'Mine.'" You know what that means? What's the scope of Christian cultural engagement? There's not a single square inch in the whole domain of human existence where those of us who recognize the lordship of Jesus Christ do not cry out His. What do? You drive a truck? What do? Retired, grandmother, farmer, engineer, doctor, missionary, pastor. All of us are in the ministry. And all of this is the scope of proper Christian engagement. So that's the first part, is the scope of it. Let me next talk about not just the scope of it, but the shape of it. In fact, I'll end with this, and I'll come back to these other points here. Let me end with the shape of it. I want to give you four questions. These are four questions that are explained in the book, and they can help us look and say, what does it mean for me to be a culture shaper where I live? Here's the first question I think Christians should ask. Number one, what good can we protect, celebrate, and promote? What good can we protect, celebrate, and promote? Christians have always championed the good. And when Christians have championed the good, things have changed. There's an unbelievable story from church history. You might know that the Romans had this practice where they had extra, too many girls in their family, and the woman would get pregnant, and they would have another daughter, and they didn't want any more daughters. They would just throw them out in the backyard. Did you hear about this? It's called exposure. And the early Christians dealt with this because the Roman culture was a culture of abortion and infanticide. And they would just take these girls, mostly girls, throw them into the backyard. The wild animals would come and eat them. And it was completely acceptable. It was normal. It was as normal as abortion is today, maybe even more so. Where Christians always champion the good. And one of the things that Christians really believed was that every single human person is made in the image of God and therefore has value. So they would go out and collect the babies. Now, that would be redemptive enough, wouldn't it, if that's all they did? But here's the impact that it had on culture. What happens in 20, 30 years if you live in a community where all the girls or most of the girls have been thrown out into the backyard and all the boys have been saved? What do you have after 20, 30 years? You have a whole bunch of men who can't get married. And men tend to want women, right? They tend to. And it's good for men because men do stupid things and women help them not do stupid things. Right? And so this is what happened. Well, here's what's interesting. Roman civilization, the Roman towns, they didn't have enough women. Who had all the women? The Christians who had went in and saved the babies. So Rodney Stark, the Baylor sociologist, says one of the explanations for the explosive growth of the church in the second century is that when Roman men wanted to get married, they had to go to church. It was like missionary dating. Or if you homeschool, missionary courting. Come on, that was funny. That was funny, wasn't it? All right, let that one go. Okay, what good can we protect, promote, and preserve? Number two, what is missing that we can offer? Christians are innovative. Christians are inventive. We think we're in the image of God, and that means we're creative. You don't get the Reformation without the printing press. Right? What is missing that we can offer? This is one of the great things. What laws are missing that we can use to bring justice? Here's the third question. What's evil that we must stop? We know that this is what Wilberforce did. A lot of people were helping slaves. Wilberforce said, slavery must stop. David DeLeiden from the Center for Medical Progress is part of a movement of millennials who have just decided. In fact, we have a chapter in our book of Restoring All Things about the pro-life movement. And by the way, do you remember back in 1973? How many of you guys remember back in 1973? I don't, but how many of you guys remember? Yeah, you know what they told us in 1973? Pro-lifers are on the wrong side of history. You remember this? You know what the statistics tell us now? Millennials are more pro-life than the Xers. And they're more creative, too. Have you noticed? They're good with cameras. Yeah. These guys are just saying evil must stop. Christians have always stopped evil. They have always been the sort of people that walked out into the world and said, no, this evil will stop. Fourth, what is broken that we can restore? What is broken that we can restore? One of the chapters in the book, the early chapter in the book, is titled this, God loveth rewords. Have you ever noticed how many rewords are in the Bible? Words that start with the letters R-E and they have to do with gospel, like redeem, renew, restore, repent. We don't like that one, but it's in there. Resurrect, right? Reconcile, right? Reconcile is the best. 2 Corinthians chapter 5. Take a look at that sometime. 2 Corinthians chapter 5. Paul says this, God was in Christ reconciling the world to himself and has given us the ministry of what?
Reconciliation.
Reconciliation. Ready? Reconciled ones are to do the work of reconciliation. Reconciled ones become reconcilers. If you look at the Bible at face value, you've got to conclude that God loves it when broken things are fixed. Broken hearts, broken lives, broken structures, broken institutions, when they're made new again. In fact, Jesus, according to the Apostle John, in his book of Revelation says, Jesus said this, behold, I am making what? All things what?
New.
All things new. All things. And God invites us to join that. So I'm with Spurgeon. Here's what Spurgeon said. How do we defend the gospel amidst all of this cultural pressure? Spurgeon said the gospel is like a caged lion. It doesn't need to be defended. It just needs to be let out of its cage. Isn't that a great line? What if we let the gospel out of its cage? Now we're going to take a break. And I owe you 5 minutes, so you can keep the 5 minutes. When we come back, what I want to do is say, how do we understand culture? And there's a theological truth that comes from the gospel that I think is a lens through which we can understand the cultural brokenness. We can find opportunities for restoration and reconciliation. And it's the idea of humanness. What does it mean to be human? So we're going to talk about that when we come back.